This is a Cult of Personality Podcast 61, published on May 22, 2009. You can find the website at www.occultofpersonality.com. This podcast is now sponsored by you, the listeners from all over the world. This episode, featuring an interview with Jake Stratton Kent, is brought to you by generous contributions from listeners, specifically Mike, Elise, and Marcus. Thank you all, I appreciate the support. Marcus also graciously provided the outro music by Arnie. Apologies for any mispronunciations. It's A-A-R-N-I. Check out the website at www.arnie.info. That's A-A-R-N-I.info. The song is entitled Logos and can be downloaded from ReverbNation.com. I want to thank sponsor Scarlet Imprint Talismanic Publishers, who provided a copy of Jake Stratton Kent's wonderful new book, The True Grimoire. To sponsor an episode, please click the donate button on the upper right corner of the occultofpersonality.com website. I also want to say a quick thanks to my friend Kylie, also Keezer, Cricket from ClimbingTowardTheLight.com, Rob, John McNair, Dan, Jeff from Media 2017, as well as everyone who's joined the Occult of Personality Facebook group over the past few weeks. You can find a link to the Facebook group on the right sidebar of the occultofpersonality.com website. I'll post show updates and news about events there, so if you're on Facebook, join the group. Both Jake and Scarlet Imprint are speaking at this weekend's Occulture Festival in London, England. That's May 23rd, 2009. Check out the website at www.occulture-festivals.com. If you're in the region, it sounds like a wonderful time, and I'll be there in spirit. Without further ado, Jake and I spoke for a little less than 35 minutes. Let's listen. Welcome to Occult of Personality Podcast. It's my pleasure to bring you today Jake Stratton Kent. Jake is acclaimed as the foremost exponent of the English Kabbalah. He's been a leading light in occult and Thelemic circles since 1984. His work with the New Equinox Journal and the Gnostic Alchemical Church of Typhon Christ are better known than his extraordinary work in the circle of Goetic magic, which he's been practicing continuously for the last 37 years. Having returned once more to the front line of the occult revival, Jake recently published his Goetic masterwork, Encyclopedia Goetica, Volume 1, The True Grimoire, a painstaking reconstruction of the Grimoireum Verum, taken from numerous corrupt sources, which have now been restored to their previous coherence through years of personal work with the spirits. I'm reading this from the occulture-festivals.com website, and Jake will be appearing as a speaker, third weekend in May at the Occulture Festival in London. Jake, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
I first became familiar with you through reading about English Kabbalah, but before we get into that, if you could tell our audience a little bit about your earlier esoteric experience, if you don't mind.
Well, sure. I started out in 1972, and my magical works always involved a hefty amount of practical, hands-on stuff, starting out with things like Mastering Witchcraft by Paul Hewson, The Key of Solomon, manuals of that kind, and later progressing to the AA curriculum and more recent equivalents like Lieber Null. And that all came before my contact with English Kabbalah. And of course, you know, I also read a lot, but study I see as is not a preparation or a precondition to magical practice, but more of an adjunct to it. So a lot of my magical work has involved what you might call the road less travelled of exploring and experiencing ancient systems and, so far as possible, not imposing modern preconceptions on them. So, for instance, not demanding the Greek magical papyri justify themselves in terms of modern chaos magic, before deigning to work with them. I guess by the late 70s, I had identified astrological timing and particularly the magical use of the lunar mansions as important areas of traditional magic that the revival had almost entirely neglected up till that point. And that's when circumstances brought me into contact with the English Kabbalah and the group initially responsible for it, who were working in pretty much exactly those areas. So while I generally prefer solo work or unaligned cooperation as it happens, on this occasion I took initiation and I devoted myself for several years to promulgating their work. And nowadays, astrological timing and even the lunar mansions aren't as neglected as they were. But the findings of that group in relation to untraditional elements of timing, say with the moon in Libra Scorpio and solar conjunctions and Everton's midpoints, I think they're still awaiting proper evaluation. And also I think important about the way they did things and the way I see things is their abandonment of Masonic structures in favour of a more coven or even cult-like environment for group ritual. I think that's still a cutting-edge precedent that the present revival could learn from. That's my kind of background and the way I feel about things.
So I'd like to get into speaking about English Kabbalah, or what some people refer to as New Aeon English Kabbalah. Would you mind speaking a little bit about how you discovered this work and how it's impacted you? I know you've done quite a bit in this field.
Well, how I discovered it, Ray Sherwin started the New Equinox magazine, and around about the time he got involved with Chaos Magic with Pete Carroll, he thought he should hand it on because it was a Thalamic journal and he was going with another current sort of thing. And he approached me initially, and then the group that had discovered EQ, Jim Lees and Carol Smith at that time, and handed it to them, and I became a writer for them and found out about their system and you know, how many, what I saw as gaps in the occult revival at that time they were actually working with. So that's how I came into contact with them. Mm-hmm. And the one claim I'd make for this Kabbalah, really, is that it is one. Interpretation of texts, names, words and phrases with Kabbalah is primarily a means of inducing gnosis. And you could call it a language for conversation with your holy guardian angel. And although Kabbalistic terms are fairly commonly encountered in the occult, I think this area is still little appreciated. And the difficult thing is that it's hard to say anything on a rational level to alter that, because it is a transrational language. But direct magical use is more accessible and can open up those higher areas. So in my magical use, I use EQ for generating rituals and ritual elements, such as talismans, magic squares, sigils, and incantations, and even generating a barbarous tongue unique to English Kabbalah. Would you like an example? Am I allowed to speak?
Oh, yeah, I'd love one, yeah. Thank you.
Zubamo Lazeti, Wawal El Kuxiel, Timo Muxuel, Petit Lowell Zulaze, Wawel Kuelfiti, Elguna Tixu El Nafi. That's an invocation of a particular genie. And that's all generated from EQ magic squares. And this approach really doesn't have to involve Dharma or interpretation of the Book of the Law. It's simply a practical approach to using English as a magical language. And it's available to any practical magician.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And language is the vehicle of consciousness and important to occultists and mystics for that reason. And if you can render it magical, that provides a really powerful transformational tool. And it's all the more potent, rather than less so, for employing a language that you use in everyday life. Greek, Kabbalah, was initially used by people who spoke Greek and Hebrew, Kabbalah. Yeah. It wasn't an exotic language to the people who initially developed it. So using your own language as a basis for Kabbalistic and magical work is very powerful and also extremely traditional.
Yes, absolutely. I'm curious about your opinion, whether it was a creation of the English language or sort of a evolution over time. It's just remarkable to me that this Kabbalah is so functional and seems to fit so perfectly.
Well, I think it's been latent in the language for quite some time. I mean, the mathematical structure behind it isn't arbitrary. There's a schema called the golden number,
mm-hmm.
which is used for in various traditions, Christian and pagan, for aligning festivals over a 19-year period, solar and lunar dating can be coordinated through the kind of math that is involved in the sequence of letters of English Kabbalah. So it's by no means random. But none of this was deliberately worked into the system. We kind of stumbled on it accidentally and then found out, you know, how it worked and how it fitted these frameworks as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
So some great mathematical genius has to come along. They probably make more sense of the structure of it than we have. We largely found out what we can do with it. These mathematical structures would have been recognized by someone like John Dee, who did calendar reform, for instance.
Right.
And he'd probably have understood them better than the current generation of occultists, including myself.
Yeah. Or maybe even somebody like Francis Bacon.
Mm, exactly.
Okay. Okay, yeah, it's fascinating. I'd encourage people who are unfamiliar with English Kabbalah to look into it, because it is very fascinating. I think most people who have looked into it and used it themselves would agree. So next, I wanted to speak about your latest book, The True Grimoire, Encyclopedia Goetica, Volume 1, by Scarlet Imprint, Talismanic Publishers. It's a beautiful volume. I'm curious, the genesis of your feeling inspired to edit, compile, and write the extensive commentary for the True Grimoire.
Well, this particular grimoire has always spoken to me, pretty much since I got involved in magic. I've been familiar with it through the works of people like Idris Shah and whatever, but it was always fragmentary. And in my vision of it, yeah, I probably have made some contextual changes, some deliberate, some possibly accidental, because, you know, I'm not a 17th century Frenchman, for instance. But my approach to it highlights its potential for bringing together contemporary developments in magic and also ancient traditions like the papyri and also New World Afro-Hispanic traditions. Because I feel that this particular grimoire can take us away from the kind of fearful approach to spirits that is very evident in other grimoires, or the virtual abandonment of spirit work in a lot of modern Western systems. And a key to how Verum is ideal for this is its employment of an intermediary spirit for initiating other spirit contacts. Now, that's extremely common in ancient magic and equally in New World traditions such as voodoo. But it's highly unusual in the grimoires and in modern magical systems, with the exception, perhaps, of the analogous but not identical concept of the Holy Guardian Angel.
Mm-hmm.
Other things I particularly like, the complete absence of a spirit torturing concept in Verum, where if it doesn't do what you want or it doesn't appear immediately, you roast the sigil and all that stuff, which I really hate, and I think comes from the spirit negative attitude of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of that in Verum at all. There's an emphasis instead on satisfying the spirits in return for their assistance. And it isn't really a huge leap from there to maintaining spirit shrines with regular offerings, as in voodoo and other traditions of that kind, which are much more, you know, positive and interactive in their relations with spirits. So Beren's very distinct from what's been called the aristocratic angel magic of other Solomonic works, and it has far more links with folk traditions. And it also includes America in its occult geography, which, you know, enhances its modernity and its compatibility with New World traditions. You know, it's just, you know, it's as if it was laying there waiting from the 17th century, just thinking, yeah, there's going to be a modern occult revival, and I'm going to fit into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a wonderful grimoire, yeah, and has massive potential. And yet it's been neglected for a hell of a long time. Largely because it differs so much from in its concept from the others, but I think those differences are what makes it more important now.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you, especially what you highlighted in regards to the way the operator would treat the spirits more on equal terms, I guess, non-threatening.
Yeah, an actual relationship, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that definitely seems like it fits more in, at least in these times. I found the work to be just really amazing. A lot mm-hmm. of the comparing and contrasting with different volumes and the way you very much, it seems painstakingly, with a great attention to detail, going through the explanations of the sigils, the differences, the way they're used, the names, and so forth. I think the analysis it really comes through in the book.
Thank you.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about Goetia in general. If you could just give us a quick overview of what is Goetia, and then we can talk a little bit more about its significance.
Well, I think Goetia is much misunderstood. Our point of view of it is fairly late and comes from the devalued sense of the word. And it seems that initially Goetia what was known in ancient Greece before the classical period, but by the time we get into the classical period, where there's, you know, philosophers and whoever writing about it, it's already been devalued.
Mm. Okay.
So and that devaluation continues on through Renaissance authors who like using classical terms. So you know, Goetia is usually used as a term of abuse for the other guy's magic. Yeah, not our high transcendental magic, but the other guy's superstitious and nasty magic. And so it's necessary to really reappraise it. You have to do quite a lot of historical research, or hope that somebody else does,
mm-hmm.
which is what I'm in the process of doing with the second volume. It's going back to ancient Greece and the influences on them. I think it's well overdue, although some academics have been aware of this for some time. I think the occult is yet to catch up.
Hmm.
But hopefully we're getting there. But it's always involves spirit work. I mean, that has always been central. And it's got substantial connection with ancient funerary rites as well. Crowley and so on translated Goetia as howling, but a better word would have been lamenting. In the context of funerary rites, where the soul is actually guided to the underworld, you know, for their benefit, but also for the benefit of the community who don't want ghosts hanging around.
Mm.
And, you know, hence Goetia and necromancy have rather a lot in common.
Mm.
And if you can take somebody to the underworld, you can also bring them back for less sociable purposes.
Mm.
So that's the original historical background of Goetia. And the words for hostile dead and for demons are usually pretty much interchangeable in Greek and other cultures. I mean, demon frequently means, you know, something like angry ghost rather than a fallen angel or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fascinating. I mean, you've been practicing it for several decades now, is that correct?
Yeah. which doesn't make me an antisocial person particularly. Yeah.
One thing you mentioned, you touched upon briefly, was the significance of language, words, and speech. And I'd like you to explain a little bit about the significance of the parchment and its use in goetic operations, and why it's so crucial and labor-intensive.
Right. Well, I deal with the present context of Goetia and how it's developing in chapters about the New World, and that's where I think Goetia is heading. But I also place emphasis on the parchment and the sigils, and that highlights where it's coming from. The pact, which takes various forms, either a single document or even a full-scale book of spirit signatures and conjurations, which is a pact with an entire hierarchy. That use of parchment is the key reason why it's emphasized time and time again in so many different grimoires. And I think my commentary is the first time that this key element of magical practice has been elucidated and the centrality of the parchment made clear, even though, you know, there's this very visible emphasis in the sources. It hasn't been brought out before. So in essence, the parchment and the way it's used, it's simultaneously a statement of the magician's intentions. And also through the employment of magical symbols, particularly spirit signatures, is the means of realizing those intentions. Yeah, and that's why it's so central. And this idea appears to be extremely ancient. And there's references to contracts with gods and spirits in Hellenistic Egypt. Some of the early church fathers write about it, and that's where this whole negative idea of the pact originates. And the connection with writing and magic, you know, we use words like spells, and grimoire is connected to words like grammar. And some of the earliest magical alphabets, like celestial script, appears to derive from signatures of entities associated with the Decans, who are an extremely ancient part of Egyptian cosmology. And in Verum, the use of signatures of spirits as magical devices is completely restored in a very modern way. I mean, it's got parallels with the work of people like Austin Spare and whatever, but at the same time, it is extremely ancient, and it's in the grimoire in Verum that it really returns into the grimoire current. And this again underlines the unique significance of this particular grimoire. A technical point. Joe Peterson points out that the large sigil array attributed to Skirlin was originally a specialized magical circle. But I consider that the adaptation of it in Verum to become the main inscription on the parchment is an intelligent and intentional part of the evolution of the system. And it's by no means unique in the history of magical manuscripts for a design of that kind to change roles. I mean, there's Rankin and Skinner's Veritable Key, for instance. You see designs there for pentacles, but if you look at the heptameron, the exact same design principles are used for magic circles. So an inscription can change roles. It can switch from a circle design to a talisman design, and I think that's what happened with the big sigil array in Verum. Although it was once used for something else, its use in Verum is completely intentional. That wasn't too technical a point.
No, it's fascinating. I think all of these correspondences are very, very interesting that you mention, especially the modern and the ancient meeting in this work. I'd like to read from the introduction section where you talk about the importance of the grimoire in the book, and you've mentioned some of these points, but I'd just like to read this and get your additional comments. This is from page 10, speaking about the grimoire in Verum. It enables the persistent seeker to see essentially what many have failed to see, that underlying goetic magic is a hidden tradition of great depth and significance. It possesses a traditional methodology that confronts and deals directly with the same primal realities faced by our most remote ancestors, in which all later magic and religion had their original impetus, but which in the West is primarily preserved in Goetic magic alone. As the anthropology of prehistory has shown, it was this rejected knowledge that initiated human evolution, giving the capacity for abstract or symbolic thought first activated in magic and ritual, and thus for all subsequent scientific and cultural advances. In these elements, its integrated completeness and primal power lays the importance and the truth of the true grimoire. It's a very powerful argument for its importance.
Yep, and it's absolutely sincere. There's been anthropological studies as a question asked in a big scientific survey. So at what point did we stop being primates and start being humans? And they isolated the origins of ritual. As soon as these beings started putting handprints on cave walls and performing strange rituals, that's the point at which we become human. Right? When abstract thought activated in ritual, caused this change in our consciousness, and we no longer just animals, but something else. And that is what Goetic magic taps us into, is that primal ritualistic state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not exaggerating when I say that those origins initiate the whole of our cultural development ever since. Without Goetic magic, we wouldn't have a civilization, we wouldn't have science, we wouldn't have art. It's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, there have been times in certain conversations people have argued in terms of Goetic evocation, whether this is internal or these are external, these spirits that are being contacted. Is that something in your mind that is even worth considering?
On a practical level, it's largely irrelevant. And a lot of people have a go at Jung and say he just turned them into parts of the brain. Well, there's quotations in Jung which completely contradict that, where he says that the separate existence of spirits is the simplest and most straightforward explanation for certain phenomena. And in a ritual context, there's no point intellectualizing.
Exactly.
The purpose of ritual is to recontact the mythic part of the brain, that responds to symbols and images. And a cold analytical approach to them, saying these are just complexes in my cerebral cortex, it's just unhelpful. You may as well consider them as completely objective entities.
Right.
It's much more straightforward, and it enables you to immerse yourself in ritual practice in a much more straightforward fashion.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. It makes sense.
Well, you take a name like Persephone, for instance. Plato knew the name Persephone. I know the name. You know the name. Crowley knew the name. So the concept, the personality of Persephone is not dependent on any single consciousness. It outlives any single human being. And to that extent, it's living within all of us. And could outlive all of us. So it's... It's just nonsense to say that it's just a part of an individual's brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Would you please describe your experience in working with Scarlet Imprint to produce this amazingly lovely book?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. I found they were very empathic with what I was doing. And I think they're just coming to their own, because they've been around for a couple of years now. And people might have underestimated them at first. I think they've got a real vision. They've got appreciation for the past, where magic's come from. And but they're also anticipating the future rather than being stuck in a purely contemporary groove where, and afraid to take risks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that's how I look forward very much to working with them again. And another comparative newcomer in UK occult publishing, it deserves an honourable mention, and that's Hadean Press. I think both Scarlet Imprint and Hadean Press are going to be names to conjure with as magic in the 21st century finds its feet.
Yeah, I would agree. So I'd like to spend our last few minutes, if you don't mind, sort of looking towards the future. You mentioned you're going to be continuing the Encyclopedia Goetica series. So if you wouldn't mind just touching on that briefly, and then perhaps the plans beyond that and what you see in terms of magic going forward, as you said, in the 21st century.
Well, Goetic magic is certainly my focus. And I see a new synthesis that could well be emerging from globalized culture. But most of Western magic as we know it, it derives ultimately from the Hellenistic era, the Greek intellectual tradition was synthesizing magical and religious systems from all over the known world. I think the global era, there's potential for a completely new synthesis, which will incorporate traditions that won't all be Western, I'm afraid, and they won't all be English-speaking. I focus, part of the major focus in Verum, in my edition of Verum, that makes it different, is the focus on the New World traditions, particularly Kimbanda, which directly incorporates elements of Verum. So, although it's an old grimoire, it's still relevant in living traditions in the 21st century. And it's kind of ironic that I live in England, further away from Afro-Hispanic traditions in the New World than a lot of other contemporary magicians are. But this specific grimoire is being used in Kimbanda, and this highlights my personal agenda, because I certainly have one, of broadening the revival and returning spirit work to central position in modern Western practice. And the Western and Anglophone elements of the revival, they're not going to be the only contributors to an emerging global synthesis. Now, at least as much is going to come out of the Afro-Hispanic traditions, let alone traditions outside Europe and the Americas. So, really, as far as Verum goes, my edition, I end up with the New World traditions and Kimbanda, but we've also got to go back into the past and reappraise the roots of Goetia and its links to the mystery cults. Most of the earliest references to Goetia, in fact, the earliest reference is a reference to Orpheus, and but Plato later on again uses Goetia in talking about the Orphic movement. So these were the founders of the mystery traditions on Samothrace and in Crete and within mainland Greece and in Asia Minor. People like Pythagoras, he was called a goes, meaning a wizard.
Mm-hmm.
In Empedocles, who gave us the concept of the four elements, was referred to as a goes. And these are major philosophers. And yet, in the context they lived, they were magicians as well as mathematicians and philosophers and so on. There was no contradiction.
Right.
And I think we've been focused too long on the Egyptian and Hebrew pseudo history of magic, and have ignored this very real cultural tradition that comes through Greco-Roman culture that underlies the whole of Western civilization. And how much of our magical traditions connect with that? And Kabbalah was only introduced into Western magic in the 15th century. So it was almost New Age at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've got there's some bipolar thing, you know, the new world, the new synthesis that's emerging in the globalized world, but also we need to reappraise the proper history of our magical tradition before it goes into the melting pot. And I think it's long overdue, and I wish I had better academic qualifications to undertake it, but fortunately, the academic world is paying serious attention to the cultural importance of magical traditions now. And in a lot of ways, you know, that's been going for the last 30 years or more, they've actually outstripped contemporary occultist knowledge of their own tradition.
Which is fascinating in and of itself.
We do tend to get stuck in a rut from time to time and not look outside what we think we know. And a lot of what we think we know, gets swept away just by one academic like Ron Hutton comes along and says, "Oh, sorry, this myth of the origins of modern pagan witchcraft is completely redundant." And he makes a very interesting point that the only continuous tradition within the whole neo-pagan occult movement is ritual magic of the Goetic type. You know, that is our authentic link with the past. It's the continuous strand that runs right the way through the Western tradition of magic. It's Goetic magic.
Very, very interesting. And I don't think I've heard too many people talk about that, I'll be quite honest. You know, hopefully you're going to reach a lot of people with your book and this podcast interview and your appearance at the culture festivals. So, Jake Stratton, Ken, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this evening.
It's been my pleasure.
I recommend for anyone interested The True Grimoire, Encyclopedia Goetica, Volume 1 from Scarlet Imprint. It's just a fascinating and beautiful work. I think anyone who's serious about Goetic magic and the origins of magic and this idea of a syncretic tradition both in the past and the future should take the time to check it out.
Thank you very much, Craig. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been my pleasure.
Law and marriage, so be my grave.